The second interruption came about an hour later. The flat was empty, apart from us and the maid. We heard the doorbell, and then the maid knocked and said two S.A. men were outside. They were two coarse, plump young men in brown shirts and breeches and marching boots. Not S.S. sharks, just the kind of people who might otherwise be delivering a case of beer, and touch their caps mumbling rough thanks for the tip. They were clearly unused to their new position and task, and they covered up their embarrassment by a certain strident stiffness. "Heil Hitler!" they chorused at the top of their voices. Silence. Then the one who was obviously senior asked, "Are you Dr. Landau?" "No," answered Frank, "his son." "And you?" "I'm a friend of Mr. Landau," I said. "And where is your father?" "He's gone to the clinic with my brother," answered Frank. He spoke slowly and measured his words. "What's he doing there?" "My brother needs an operation." "Well, that's all right then," said the SA man, genially gratified. "Show us the consulting room."
"If you please," said Frank,
and he opened the door. The two men stomped past us into the consulting room, which lay empty, white, and tidy before them, and looked severely at the many shining instruments. "Any patients today?" asked the spokesman.
"No,"
said Frank. "Well, that's all right then," he said again. It seemed to be his catchphrase. "Show us the other rooms." And he stomped through the flat with his companion, casting disapproving, inquisitive glances all around, a bit like a bailiff choosing items to impound. "So nobody else has been here," he said at last, and after Frank had confirmed this, "Well, that's all right then," a third time. We stood at the front door again, and the two men hesitated, as though they felt they ought to do something now. Then out of the general silence they suddenly chorused, "Heil Hitler!" at the tops of their voices again, and stomped down the stairs. We shut the door behind them and returned to our work in silence. Time ran away with us, and toward the end we acted more and more summarily. Whole packets of letters were thrown into the waste-paper basket unread. Perhaps we felt more strongly than an hour ago how completely destroyed and done with our youth had become. What did it matter if its vestiges were obliterated? 5 o'clock. We tied up the box and surveyed our work of destruction. "I'll pack the other stuff sometime tonight," said Frank. He still had to phone the clinic, and I had to phone Charlie. Then he told the maid he was leaving. "Do your parents know about your engagement?" "No, it would be too much at once for them. It will all just have to take its course." At the kiosk there was a copy of Angriff, Attack, which had just come off the press. It had the cheering headline, Storm Signals. We took the suburban railway and rode from the east through the centre of Berlin and out again to the west. In the train we had a chance to talk for the first time that day, but we did not have a real conversation. Too many people got in and out and sat near us. We could not tell whether they were informers, and then there were so many things to organize with which we had to interrupt ourselves, messages, favors, and errands that we had to arrange. His plans? They were vague enough. First he wanted to do a Swiss Ph.D. to survive as a student on 200 marks a month. This amount could still legally be sent abroad. He also had some kind of uncle in Switzerland. Perhaps he could help out. "The main thing is to get out. I'm worried that soon they won't let us out." In truth, that day the whole potion had already been brewed, though it was put on ice again and only administered 5 years later. At Wannsee Station, Ellen was waiting for us. Wordlessly, she showed us a newspaper. It contained this item, "Exit visas introduced." The justification was again, I believe, the alleged spreading of horror stories abroad. "It looks as though we're already trapped," said Frank. Ellen, a self-controlled and well-brought-up young lady, suddenly punched the sky with clenched fists, a gesture more suited to the stage or pictures in a museum. It was startling, coming from a well-dressed young lady in a leafy suburb. "Perhaps it won't take effect immediately," I said. "Anyway," said Frank, "we must hurry all the more now. We may just be lucky. If not, too bad." We went through a few streets lined with villas, past gardens. It was quiet here, and there was nothing visible that indicated what was going on today, not even graffiti on shop windows. Ellen had hooked her arm under Frank's, and I carried the box with his papers. Dusk was gathering, and a warm drizzle began to fall. I felt a certain numbness in my head. Everything was deadened by a deep feeling of unreality. but there was also something threatening in the air. We had fallen too suddenly and too deeply into the impossible for there to be any limits. No one would be really surprised if tomorrow all the Jews were to be arrested or ordered to commit suicide as a punishment for some trumped-up charge. S.A. men would say, "Well, that's all right then," genially gratified when they were told that the Jews had all properly killed themselves. The streets would look the same as always. "Well, that's all right then." The villas would be unchanged in their friendly gardens, blustery spring weather and drizzle. I gave a start. We had arrived. And I was disconcerted because I was a stranger and had no reason to be there. I need not have worried. Ellen's family's house was so full that nobody noticed me. From the outside it had appeared quiet, reserved, distinguished. Inside it was more like a refugee camp trying vainly to pretend it was a tea party. About 20 guests sat or stood around in the large, elegant reception rooms, apparently younger family friends used to visiting the house who had come to find assistance and consolation today, here where they were used to taking tea and listening to music. They found only the anxiety and worry of their friends, and the polite, courteous atmosphere was suffused with an air of suppressed panic. Tea was offered. The guests stirred their cups and said, "Please," and "Thank you." It was almost the usual murmured conversation of a tea party, but the murmuring was so uneasy that one would not have been surprised if there had been a sudden scream. I knew one of the guests a little. He was a referendar like me, and he had come to ask Ellen for a translation. He had drafted a letter to a lawyer in Brussels, in whose office he had worked for a time. "Here it is," he said, and pulled a scrap of paper from his inside pocket. Perhaps his life depended on this scrap of paper. "Let me have a look," said Ellen, and she began to scribble between his lines, but then she was called away. Somebody else wanted her for something. She came back and scribbled a bit more, but then her mother called her again. When she returned, she was almost at her wit's end and mumbled to herself, "Referenda. What's the French for referenda?" Suddenly she burst out, "Look, I'm sorry, please don't be angry. I simply can't do it today, not now." "But of course, not at all," the poor man said politely, his face falling. The host, Ellen's father, a portly, friendly man, forced a smile and tried to raise the depressed mood by telling jokes. Ellen's mother drew Frank into a corner to discuss the news about the exit visas with a few others. I joined the group. "If we only knew when it came into effect," somebody said. "Doesn't it say in the paper?" asked another. "Not a word, that's the trouble. Have a look." Ellen's mother produced another copy of the newspaper, which already looked rather tattered. "You only have to phone the police," I suggested. "But that might just cause us more trouble," somebody replied. "You can always give a false name," I said. "Anyway, I'd be happy to do it if you wish." "Are you really prepared to do it?" exclaimed Ellen's mother. The general relief was as great as if I had offered some momentous service. "But please, please, not from our phone," she begged. I realized that her surface poise was thin and crumbling, and that, although she was still smiling, she felt more like screaming. "If you would do us that great favor, there's a telephone box just around the corner. Here, wait a minute, I'll get some coins."